Welcome to the Ortho Joe Podcast, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. Join hosts Mohit Bhandari and Mark Swankowski as they discuss current topics and publications in the world of orthopedics and beyond.
Well, it's a sunny morning here in Minnesota, 31 degrees. I can feel the winter.
Yes, it's crisp. Today's the first crisp morning I felt in Ontario as well. Mark, I mean, it's a nice, crisp morning. I can feel it. I think the temperature is about 3 degrees Celsius here. So we're, however you convert that over, but it's about 3 degrees Celsius.
Yeah. And I just really hope we have a real winter. We didn't have a real winter, only 8 inches of snow or something like that compared to our usual 52, and no cross-country skiing or any. It was not good. But the prospects for further climate change, I think, this past week have increased. Let's just put it that way without getting into politics. And
that's true. But I would definitely say, yes, there's some big changes happening. But I'll tell you, what happens in U.S. usually has the same wave in Canada. So I expect 2025 in Canada, pretty much a mirror of what is happening in the U.S.
Yeah. Well, let's pray we have a real winter. But anyway, it's cold enough. I've got my mug out.
I don't have a mug. I got here. I was in search of internet access. So unfortunately, my priority was internet access, and I'm happy I have it. And so we are where we are. But it's okay. I'll get coffee right after.
Yeah. Well, you mean you didn't stop at Tim Hortons on the way in?
No, because it was a calculus I had to do, right? You know, like get to the access, get the everything fired up, and, you know, my luck. But now that I got here, I could have easily gotten a coffee. You know, it's always hindsight.
Right. Well, I want to start out this morning with talking to perhaps, I think it's legit to state that you are the most experienced orthopedic surgeon in conducting controlled trials to date in your career, which is only half over, I would say.
But I would say that that field is wide and big, and I absolutely will not be that person probably soon, and probably not even now if you were to talk to some of the groups. There's some amazing stuff happening. But yes, I have.
You have some experience.
I've had many sleepless nights, you know, trying to get our sample sizes, trying to get our files, and trying to get these things functioning.
And I know that you've had the same experience I have had when you present the results of a trial in the discussion period or maybe in the hallway afterwards about people pushing back against trials. And isn't something obvious, and isn't a small cohort study enough to prove that the intervention is effective? And they often throw the example, are you advocating for doing a trial of parachutes? Because there was a famous article, I think it was in the BMJ, about no need for parachutes. And one of the topics that always comes up in that is, you know, there's never been a trial on the effectiveness of total hip replacement, and we don't need one. And I happen to notice in the October 31st, Halloween Day issue of New England Journal of Medicine, a group of investigators from Denmark, did a trial, and it's called total hip replacement or resistance training for severe hip osteoarthritis. And a group of investigators enrolled 109 patients, age 76.6 years, randomly assigned to total hip replacement or resistance training.
Mark. Let me guess the hypothesis. Can I guess the hypothesis that if you get a total hip replacement versus doing no total hip replacement in people with severe hip osteoarthritis, I'm going to guess the total hip replacement is going to win. I'm going to guess. It's a pure guess. I have no idea. Not even a guess.
Well, a small trial with, you know, you've also spoken a bit on the risks of small trials. But they used the Oxford Hip Score, and 15.9 point improvement as a mean on total hip and 4.5 point mean improvement with resistance training. And at 6 months, 5 patients who had been assigned to total hip replacement had not undergone surgery, and 12 patients, or nearly a quarter, who had been assigned to resistance training had undergone total hip replacement. So as you point out, they conclude that total hip replacement in patients over the age of 50 with severe hip osteoarthritis is an effective intervention. So,
and actually also interesting, if you look at the numbers of crossovers, if you get randomized to the group that said, well, we're going to do resistance training, there's a 2.5 times likelihood that you're going to flip over and cross over. So the crossovers are really one way for the most part. They're going from non-operative to operative group. So even more, I guess, support in favor of doing that procedure. The curious thing is I guess there's lots of curious things about a randomized trial of 50 patients on either arm getting published in the New England Journal of Medicine, Mark. But why do you think that is? I mean, genuinely, why do you believe so? And remember, there was a paper not that long ago, maybe under a decade ago, that did the same thing. A relatively small study of about 100 patients or less looked at total hip replacement versus physiotherapy and had the exact same finding.
Yeah. Well, so I believe it's because people in scholarly publication and academic medicine have heard the same issue all over. You know, there's never been a randomized trial on total hip replacement yet. You know, it's an effective procedure. Everybody knows it. The patients know it. This is common knowledge. So I think that's why I got published. And so the question for you is, do we need randomized trials on every intervention?
Well, I mean, absolutely not. And, you know, and I guess you could argue with this particular study, you know, that let me first say a huge kudos to the authors, huge kudos to them for, you know, designing a study, completing it, getting patients to randomize out of a total joint replacement if, in fact, they have severe knee, severe hip OA. Like, that's this is no small task for them to do. So huge congratulations to them. But I do wonder if, you know, if there was, you know, a blue sky version of this trial, one might think of a slightly longer follow-up. One might try to get more patients in. I realize it's powered and had a massive effect. And maybe because it had such a big effect with such a small number of patients, one might either ask, is it a spurious effect? Or number two, do we even need the study? If it's that obvious, do we even need the study, which is your point. But you could have chosen other outcomes besides function, right? Because there was no difference in what they called, serious adverse events. But the truth is, you don't look long enough at 6 months to know. So there's all kinds of ways in which this could have been a 1,000 patient study, 500 patient study. But anyways, it is what it is.
To that issue, though, Mo, I believe that it would be really hard to have a funding agency fund a 1,000 patient trial. Because the people that are evaluating the grant application are going to say the same thing. Well, this is obvious. We don't need to spend this money doing this trial because everybody knows. So there's a dilemma.
You're right. But again, like when you forget the topic or the title. When you look at a study of 100 patients, rarely are the patients truly balanced. Like you're not going to have true absolute prognostic balance in 50 patients per arm. So there are a host of methodological limitations to small trials.
Right.
And the biggest one is people believe them, right? That's the danger with small trials in general, not this one, just in general. So it's interesting how some of that stuff gets overlooked when it's a topic of interest. You know, John Ioannidis. Peter Giannis is great, great publisher, so I get them mixed up a lot. But John Ioannidis often said, you know, the reason a lot of research findings get published and often turn out to be, you know, contrary or be proven false, not that this one would be, is it's a hot topic, small trials, and conflicts of interest. I don't think there's any conflicts here, but definitely it fits the hot topic area because, you know, hot topic in the context of non-operative, could non-operative be as good as a total hip replacement, would be the way they would have sold this. And we don't know that maybe resistance training is way different than physio. You know, in other words, what they did is not what we do, but it was a good argument, but you're right. I think at the end of the day, I don't think it's particularly novel news to those who treat patients with severe hip osteoarthritis. But that being said, it's worth reading and worth being aware of. Because, I mean, maybe there might be patients who talk about the need, you know, want to go stay non-operative. And certainly you've got more evidence now to say, well, this definitely has a benefit. But to your point, And because this is a holiday issue, a holiday a podcast, and you know, today's date does not, you know, it's a date where we should be thinking about other interesting studies that are where you don't need randomization. So here's one for you. There was a study in the holiday issue, December 2011 of the BMJ. And for those of our listeners who don't typically follow that journal, they have a holiday issue where they do some interesting topics. And here's the title of this one, Mark. Orthopedic Surgeons, As Strong as an Ox and Almost Twice as Clever, a Multi-Center Prospective Comparative Study. Now, this study looked at to compare the actual intelligence of orthopedic surgeons versus their arch nemesis, the anesthetist, apparently. That's how they set this up. And they wanted to look at strength and intelligence testing. It was a multi-center prospective comparative study. Now, in this particular case, they wanted to make sure that they had appropriate gender matching. So they went with male and male. So they had a 30 male orthopedic surgeons, against 40 male anesthetists consultant or registrar, a registrar grade. Main outcome measures were intelligence testing and dominant hand grip strength. So how do you think it went? Orthopedic surgeons, as you can imagine, had a statistically significant greater mean grip strength, a pretty significant one. And here is where the anesthetist got wiped out. It was a clean sweep. It was mean intelligence test score of orthopedic surgeons was also statistically significantly greater. Now, their conclusion was orthopedic surgeons have greater intelligence and strength compared to their anesthetic colleagues who should find new ways to make fun of their orthopedic colleagues. I thought they nailed it.
Yeah, that's perfect. It's off the old saying, strong as a mule and twice as smart kind of thing.
But I think it was a redemption paper. So I think it's one of those gems that I bring out, when I'm getting a little ribbing. But that being said, but the more interesting paper I want to bring out to you, and interesting.
Well, let me just ask you though: do you have methodologic criticisms of that research design?
Well, sure. I mean, it was focusing only on males, which would have been nice to get, sort of a more diverse population, but also have enough sample size to test for it.
Right.
Back then, again, a small study. Could you have randomized them? Sure, you could have, I guess. Yeah. But in my mind, I think just doing a large cohort where you're looking at factors associated with an outcome. And in this case, if you were to look at factors predictive of being stronger and smarter, boy, the orthopedic surgeon just comes out. He just shows up. I mean, shows up, Mark. So, I mean, I can argue something because I'm kind of biased.
You're definitely minimizing.
I mean, this is a beautiful study. I mean, now, mind you, if it had gone the other way, I'd have 1,000 criticisms. But right now, it's pretty good.
Okay, what's the next one?
Okay, so I know something that you have. And we've golfed together a bit. I've been picking up this game through all its frustrations and trying to learn it. But there's a study that came out also in the British Medical Journal, not that long ago, pre-COVID, so 2018. And it talks about the golf habits among physicians and surgeons, an observational cohort study. Now, in short, they identified 41,000 or so U.S. physicians who are actively logged at their golf rounds in the U.S. Golfing Association database. August of 2018. So among these, among about 1 million physicians who have actually logged, who are part of this database, 41,000 or so have actually, have actively logged golf scores. So what they did is they used that tool. Now, to the extent that that's accurate, I mean, we all use tools, so I don't know how accurate that is. So there's going to be reporting bias here, but let's assume that everyone's, the log data is accurate data. Men here accounted for about 9 out of 10 of the golfers. So about 1 of the 10 were women. The highest proportion of physician golfers were, now it's physician golfers. So it could be any group. Mm-hmm. What do you think? Just if you were to take some guesses, who are the top specialty areas where you think golfing is very, very common?
I'm just going to guess.
Yeah, go ahead.
Surgeons in general, higher.
Yep. Yep.
I'm going to say plastic surgeons.
Yep.
Urologists.
Interesting.
And ENT surgeons.
Okay. That is incredible that you've picked that. And orthopedic surgery. So orthopedic surgery were the most common, 8.8%.
Oh, really? I missed that. Okay.
Yeah. Urology, 8.1%. Plastic surgeons, 7.5%. and otolaryngology 7.1. You nailed every one. That's incredible.
Okay. Part of it is because I'm a big fan of the classic Caddyshack, where it's a urologist. I think it's a urologist that snake a tube down him, and I'll be in 4 hours.
There you go. But then they also looked at who were the best golfers, so they looked at sort of like the extremes. And by the way, internists were the least. They weren't golfing much at all. So in that group as the control, they looked at who were the best. So among this group of busy golfers, the best technical golfers were thoracic surgery, vascular surgery, and orthopedic surgery were considered the best golfers, with about 15% better golf performance overall, which I thought was interesting too. So, I mean, maybe thoracic surgeons aren't commonly golfing, but the ones who golf seem to be pretty darn good, and the vascular surgeons who golf seem to be pretty darn good. And orthopedic surgeons had the most frequent golfers. So in that group, on average, it looks like they were doing pretty well.
Right.
Interesting. Right.
Well, I have a comment about the fact that internists aren't well represented in that it's a registry, right? I mean, it's a registry trial.
Yes.
USGA registry.
Right.
But the internists are much, I'm going to say, I will admit, despite published evidence, that they're more intelligent than surgeons as a group. And they have the issue of avoidance of frustration. And golf, to anybody who's ever played it, is the most frustrating game, as you and I well know. You know, you're in that zone, and it's four or five holes, and it's you think it's going to go on forever, and then it's gone for a year. And you have no idea why, or very little idea. So they want to avoid this feeling.
I'll tell you, I was with one of our surgeon scientist trainees, and it's nine holes. I haven't been paying attention to what he was at work. And then he turns to me, and it was the absolute statement of death. He goes, "I think I'm having the game of my life. The front line has been amazing. I'm running one over." And I said, "Oh man, I wish you hadn't told me, first of all." Because now I'm aware of that. And I'm going to be aware of every shot he takes now. And so that extra stress on him just blew this back nine. It was such a mental game.
They say it's the game that's played on the 6 inches between the ears. And there's a lot of truth to that. But so my point is that the more intelligent physicians want to avoid this frustration, so they keep away from it. And there you go. But on the other hand, there is that one sweet shot that almost happens every single round that gets you coming back, you know, the one perfect contact that goes where you want it to. And it's highly addictive, that feeling.
Then you say to yourself, golf is easy. Why can't I do this for the next 18 holes? Or you get that one horrible, which I do still, just horrible shot. And you think, why am I doing this? Like, this is crazy. Like, what? It doesn't make any sense. Like, I'm not getting any better. And you have this whole negative cycle, you know, that you go through. But it is interesting. It's interesting to see, though, that there is attempts at trying to quantify the burning questions that, you know, we all have
our time.
Who are the better golfers?
Who's stronger?
And who's smarter? And, you know, there's a whole bunch of other ones I could have dug up, but, you know, we'll keep it short today. But certainly I think our discussion has focused on a variety of topics, but I do think a focus on the clinical trial and the observational study was at least the, if anyone's listening takes anything away from today, that's probably what you should take away. Just ignore everything else I've been saying. But I think the idea of small trials is still a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I hope this lighthearted episode was a some interest to somebody somewhere. But
there's an internist out there saying, "Are you crazy? I'm way better." It's good again.
Way stronger, way smarter. Stronger.
Yes, just, you know, have them contact us. We want that person on. We want to talk to them.
Well, since this is being played at the holiday season, I wish you great holiday season, and
you too.
Looking forward to 25 and seeing what kind of strange stuff we can figure out how to talk about in 25.
Absolutely, and lots of great, great guests, I'm sure, coming on board. So can't wait. Have a great holiday.
Cheers.
Yeah, take care.
Go get the Tim Hortons.
I need one. Yeah.